You're listening to Pretty Much Pop, a culture podcast. Perhaps starting a whole podcast just based on a creepy animation style seems a stretch, but we thought we could do it. Today we're discussing the films of Tim Burton in light of Beetlejuice, Beetlejuice, and his vast output since the early 80s as director and writer. My name is Mark Lintonmeyer, and you don't have to say my name three times for me to show up in your ears.
I'm Al Baker, and I'm more of a Beetle kombucha guy.
I'm Sarah Lynn Bruck. Lawrence Ware, Lawrence Ware, Lawrence Ware.
Say my name and I shall appear. My name is Lawrence Ware, coming to you from the great city of Oklahoma City, Oklahoma, right here in the middle of the country. I'm living in a place where Tim Burton would never make a movie.
As a foreigner, the places that Tim Burton chooses to make movies about to me seem like it's white picket fence suburban territory. So which states is that coded around? Is it like Connecticut? Beetlejuice is set in Connecticut, isn't it?
That's right.
Is it that kind of area?
I think like Indiana kind of area. It just seems like that's the kind of place you think, like, you know, a vast place where there's corn or something. I don't know. Like, that's just what comes to mind for me, even though I have no idea if he has any kind of representation of that kind of stuff in his actual films.
Well, he's from Burbank, and that's what I always think of. And I'm very familiar with Burbank since I'm from California, but I always think of, you know, all of the houses that look the same. I think of the set design of Edward Scissorhands. That's what comes to mind, and that definitely has a California feel to me.
I think generic suburbia is supposed to be beyond any particular location. I think that's why, yeah, the line between Indiana and parts of California is very thin. I guess before we dump on or praise the new movie...
Wow, you guys did not like this movie. I'm telling all I can see already. Some of you guys didn't like it. I loved it. I love this movie.
Okay, I got to read.
I've seen it three times already. I love this movie.
Really?
Three times, amazing. Lawrence. Wow, that is dedication.
I loved it.
I mean, for doing like immediate reactions, it was fine. I'm surprised that you're that excited about it.
I really enjoyed it.
I was very disappointed.
I was distracted by a lot of things. Maybe seeing it a second time would help, though I don't want to see it a second time. But when it's a sequel, when you're so familiar with so many of these actors, when you're just looking for tropes, when you're, I don't know, it's hard to be enchanted by the mood that they're trying to put over, that it's more noticing things. It wasn't until about the last 20 minutes I'm like, you know, this movie is actually pretty bad. But before that, I was at least an interested observer.
I didn't like it a lot, but I had really low expectations coming in.
Oh, that's the key.
And it handily cleared those low expectations, because I'm sure this is going to be a feature of our conversation. Like, Tim Burton has not been a consistent filmmaker. And this may have been the best film of his I've seen in a long time, but that it really is the definition of damning with faint praise.
Let's go, Sarah. Get your shots off. Let's go before I begin to be effusive with my praise.
I almost feel like we should start with the more positive. I think one problem that I had with this movie was that the day before I had watched the original Beetlejuice, which is, as we all know, a gem. So I went into it with very high expectations. I should have pulled an Al and went in with very low expectations. And that's just not what happened. And as soon as the theme music came up, I was so excited. I was really ready to be taken for a ride. And this movie just like was all over the place. And there were definitely some great performances. I thought Michael Keaton was great, but still there was just so many plots. He could not have crammed more plots in there if he tried. It was such a mess. It was such a mess of a movie. I was very, very disappointed.
Well, I love this movie. This movie was by far very, very fun for me. Now, I will say this. The movie has way too much going on. So, for example, the Monica Bellucci whole plot could have gotten rid of that. The Justin Theroux, the whole plot there could have gotten rid of that. And the movie would not have been changed whatsoever. So those things I didn't love. I didn't love the first 45 minutes or so, right? Getting started.
That's kind of a lot, Lawrence.
I didn't. let me finish. Let me finish before you guys shit on what I'm saying. The first 45 minutes, yeah, it kind of drug a little bit. I mean, it had some quirky moments or whatever. But once it got going and you were in the other world and all that kind of stuff, I genuinely enjoyed it, right? So for me, it's not one of those things. And again, I'm going to say this and preface this by saying I like horror movies, guys. So I am able to say, I enjoy this part of the movie, but I don't need the totality of the movie to work for me. So that being said, what worked for me really, really worked for me. I love the Beetlejuice world. I love the way that the Beetlejuice character is so deeply uncomfortable. Like, if you think about that first Beetlejuice movie, there's like this 100-year-old demon trying to marry a teenager. That is weird. That is so strange, right? And so this movie kind of does that. It has fun with it. I genuinely enjoyed it. I thought that the musical number was fun. It was a good selection of a musical number. I love the acting and the overacting of it. It was fun for me. Now, is it a great movie? No. Is it a good movie? Yes. Is it an example of high cinema? No. Is it Tim Burton's greatest film? No. Is it the best thing he's made in like 10 years? Absolutely. Absolutely the best thing he's made in 10 years. And so I don't need this movie to knock me out of my socks to enjoy it. I could just enjoy a film. I'm a film critic who, when I'm watching the films that are being put up for Oscars, I come in with what Sarah has, that hardcore, it needs to work on every single level. But when I'm just enjoying and I'm having fun, I let the movie have fun. And I had fun with it. And the Soul Train thing was hilarious. Loved it. It was fun.
I know. Did they need to do it as many times as they did it, though?
They did it twice.
Yeah. Yeah, it was one too many.
It was one joke.
Well, it's one too many.
I enjoyed it. It was fun.
Mark, what was your...
Yeah, what was your take?
I thought I gave it, which is that...
Oh, he didn't like it. He didn't like
overall, it. Overall, yes. In retrospect, there were not enough redeeming qualities about it to make it worth sitting through, I feel. So I went on a Tim Burton deep dive here, and I rewatched a lot of stuff. I watched for the first time some of his recent stuff, and I think he is a solid director. He is mostly a director, of course, not a writer. So I don't know that he can be blamed for the myriad of plots and how clumsy or not clumsy the appropriation of the old material. For instance, like, oh, we have to have the sandworm save. This is a stupid, who cares if it's a spoiler? It's just a dumb plot element. But like, oh, we have to have every significant thing from the previous movie come in at least twice.
Right. The shrinking head thing was a punchline from the first movie, and it was quick. And then it became a major character for some reason. And then there were 100 of them. Like, I didn't understand why we needed to have that.
It was more like 10. But it was fun. I agree, it was silly. Like, the silly parts of this movie, and here's the thing. The first Beetlejuice movie, it is a quirky movie. It's a really, really good movie. But, like, the plot kind of doesn't matter in that film. Like, it's the world. It's the ambiance. It's enjoying it.
Yeah.
And if you compare the first film to the second film, the first film is so strange and so weird and such a one-of-its-kind kind of thing. It's not going to compare. Like, don't compare the movie. But if you just, like, accept it for what it is, I thought it was fine. And people clearly enjoyed it because this movie is making a lot of money in the box office. So clearly, people are enjoying this.
I'm glad people are enjoying it. But it is a really interesting... So the reason I went in with low expectations is because legacy sequels like this one, what you go in expecting is that what the movie is going to be is basically a retread of all the bits of the original movie that the audience is going to remember. The reason I wasn't disappointed by the movie is because the vast majority of
exactly what
Beetlejuice is. The bits that I was pleasantly surprised by was some of the other bits. So granted, it's messy, but the reason it's messy seems to me to be that Tim Burton had other ideas and he wanted an excuse to get some of them up on screen. And that for me is what made the movie more interesting, was that there was this stuff that wasn't just a retread of the original Beetlejuice movie, but it was kind of tonally similar and harked back to a lot of early Tim Burton stuff. It was not strong Tim Burton stuff, but it was enough to let me know that Tim Burton still has some kind of creative juices flowing. And it was nice to see some of that old sensibility back up on the screen.
Mm-hmm. I always like the worlds that he creates, but again, to come back to some of the extraneous characters, did we really need the Justin Theroux character?
It's kind of a cliche at this point, that sort of somebody who's in there taking advantage of the, I don't know, I just feel like I've seen this in several movies.
Completely agree.
Totally. And I also thought that Winona Ryder was totally wasted in this part. I thought it was almost
really?
Like, yes, I thought she was almost playing a different character than from the first one. She had so much more fire to her in the first one. She had some spunk. She was kind of a rebel. I mean, she had so much more energy. And this one, she just had so little agency. I was like, is this really the same character?
I agree entirely. And it's kind of a wasted opportunity because Winona Ryder happens to have grown into an absolute world-class actor. And you could have made her really the centerpiece of the movie and done something really kind of interesting with it.
Right.
But in this movie, she's dealt with loss. She's doing a career that she really doesn't want to do. She's exploiting the gift that she has, and she's not. So she is a different character. She's a beaten down version of that character. She is an older character. She's not happy with her mom, but she kind of made peace with it. And she's completely estranged from her daughter. That would do that to you.
Still, if she has evolved so much, then why hasn't she evolved out of the hairstyle that she wore in 1989? I mean, she's still wearing the same costume.
But she's still a weirdo.
Because the audience has to recognize that it's the same person. So no one is allowed to have a different hairstyle.
No. Okay. All right.
The fact that her mother is literally saying, you got to find that spunky goth chick within yourself.
They're speaking to exactly what you're saying, Sarah. I mean, but that's true, though. Okay, you guys can act like you have turned middle-aged and you're still the same spunky person that you were when you were a teenager.
Hey.
Me, a grown man, okay, maybe you are. And I've had ups and downs. I've had losses. I've had disappointments. And I am now a genuinely different person than I was when I was 18 years old. I think I'm a better person. I think it's okay for characters to change when that much time has passed.
I agree. However, you are still, there's still some of...
Not really. I know what you're about to say. Not really.
Little boy Lawrence in there. Like, there's still...
You almost called me Larry. Oh my gosh, we were about to fight.
Sorry.
I think little boy Larry is your rap name.
It absolutely is not. You guys are on a whole different plane today. I don't know what you're doing today.
I do think that there is still, you know, a core to all of us that we do change and we grow and we evolve. We hope, you know, fingers crossed. However, I just didn't think that this was the same character. It would be fine if she was beaten down by the things that had happened in her life, if she had been given something to do, something that wasn't just reacting off of. It's like, oh, you're going to get married. Oh, okay. I guess I'm going to get married now. Like, who says that? I don't know. It didn't fly with me.
Because you're right, Lawrence is in there, but it would have been good to see that have more screen time, that bit of character development have more screen time and it be, you know, maybe the focus of what the movie turned on. One of the problems with having so many moving parts in a movie, like throwing so much at the screen, is that you don't get to properly flesh out any single theme. And you can see a version of this movie where they really, it's also thematically works beautifully when you're developing a legacy sequel like this, which is for a property which is definitely past its time. You know, it's old, it's knackered. Tim Burton's old and knackered, is now selling out his formerly prodigious and interesting talent in a lot of less interesting ways. I can see a version of this movie which is more thoroughly like about that and deals with those kinds of themes. But this one, like, threw that in. That's in the pot, but it's in the pot among everything else that got thrown into the screen.
But do you guys really want a Beetlejuice movie?
No, I didn't want another Beetlejuice movie at all.
I didn't either. However, since I got it, I don't want people wrestling with deep heavy. The original Beetlejuice movie, there's not any level of character development that deep. Not really.
But it was still such a simple story. And it was so easy just to fall into that world. And since we knew what was going on, all of the character development and stuff actually didn't really even matter all of that much. But we were focused on, I mean, the two main characters were actually Gina Davis and Alec Baldwin. They had a ton of screen time. And it was really revolving around them just trying to get this family out of their house. That was it. And that was enough.
Beetlejuice himself, I guess, hardly any screen time in the first.
Exactly.
In the first movie. And it is, you're right, it is far less a character or plot piece than it is just a piece of, like, world exploration. I rewatched the original one as well, and it reminded me a lot of Terry Gilliam movies, like Brazil or something. All of the best stuff is, here's the waiting room and all the characters in the waiting room, and let's just, like, sit here for a bit and, like, revel in the silliness and the satire and this conception of the afterlife and all that, like, the really grim jokes about how everyone who works in civil administration in the afterlife is a suicide case. So they're all,
yeah,
everyone on rails in their nooses and everything.
Yeah,
that's all. Yeah, that's all great. And like for a sequel, if we had to have the sequel, what I would have liked to see is like more world building. Like, let's broaden out the world building a little bit rather than just retreading all the same, you know, sight gags and like moments that we had in the first one.
I think what we're getting at is maybe just a better editor. If we just pared this down quite a bit, story-wise, moments within scenes, don't have the same joke twice. Like, I mean, I was fine with now he has a, Beetlejuice has a office full of shrunken head guys doing their thing, but don't like show that seven times. Show that once and then maybe even bring the guys back just like the football players in the first one.
Right. Yeah.
So that they could all run out of the house together or something and have that scene later, but not all this in between stuff. I mean, I kind of like the idea of this is my decoy, but even that could have been done much more rapidly. And how many souls do we have to see this woman suck through her? Like, we get the point after a nice Danny DeVito cameo. Like, or
you know, and that's so true. There were moments like having her put herself back together with the staple gun was fantastic. Like, that was such a great, but then it kind of went nowhere. You know, the Willem Dafoe character I thought was super fun, but again, what was he there for? You know, it just seemed to all kind of peter out.
That was kind of the stuff that I was referring to that I thought was the most fun. I would have loved to see more exploration of these new things in the same world. And it felt like having two haunted musical numbers just got in the way of that.
Even just having the flashback to Beetlejuice as a living person, like that was a nice little...
That was interesting.
That was great because it was entirely new. It wasn't retread. Like nothing in the first Beetlejuice movie looked like that. That was a new bit of Tim Burton.
Even though then the whole reason for doing that, of introducing this character that he was married to, made no sense whatsoever. No, and her motivations being, apparently this is Tim Burton's current girlfriend, Monica Bellucci. And so he has to put his current girlfriend in every movie.
Yeah, every movie.
I mean, he does that a lot. He did it with Helena Bonham Carter. But the thing is, so that...
Lisa Marie was before that, yeah.
This is a callback to Mario Bava films. This is a callback to Italian horror films. That's exactly what that stuff looks like. And so I thought it was fun. He wanted to have some fun. Like, Tim Burton is a creative... Like, he always does weird stuff. Like, you watch Ed Wood, it's weird. Like, this is what he does. You know, Edward Scissorhands, it's weird. This is what he does. He likes to have fun with that kind of stuff. And so I enjoyed it. Like, I had no problem. Now, that Monica Bellucci character, I did not need that whatsoever. Same thing as I said about Justin Theroux. This film is overstuffed. There's way too much going on. I mean, the editor who worked on this film also worked on Scream 6. He also worked on Orphan Black. I mean, so he's a good editor, but it's clear that Tim Burton wanted to do all this stuff. He wanted to have all these things going on. And that is a byproduct of a director who's just too powerful. He needs someone to say to him, let's not do that. That doesn't make any sense. That doesn't help the story. So I agree. The story is overstuffed. There's too much stuff going on. Like, it's just all over the place. But at the core story for me, that absolutely worked. And I enjoyed it. I had a good time with it.
I'm curious because a lot of the movies that he's made that I think generally haven't worked, or a lot of people think haven't worked, have been kind of these major, like Dumbo or Miss Peregrine's Home for Peculiar Children, like Dark Shadows, Alice in Wonderland, some of these a lot of these bigger movies that have come later in his career have been seen as not working as well as his earlier ones. And I just wonder if he is someone who needs to work within a smaller budget or just smaller confines? Like, what makes his movies work, I wonder?
I have a grand theory about this.
Okay, I want to hear it.
Which comes from rewatching some of his earlier movies in the preparation for this. His great gift, I think, is in visual world building, if you like. Something I didn't know about Tim Burton before researching for this, but which makes a huge amount of sense, is that he started his career working in animation. He's like, by trade, is an animator.
CalArts.
And that makes an enormous, And that makes an enormous amount of sense of a lot of his early movies, because the early stuff, Pee-wee's Big Adventure, Edward Scissorhands, and the first Beetlejuice, you can describe the combined aesthetic of those movies as cartoonizing live action cinema is a lot of what's going on. In my view, one of the big kind of bellwethers for Tim Burton becoming less interesting as a filmmaker is the advent of CGI. And if you look at Charlie and the Chocolate Factory, and if you look at Alice in Wonderland, Dumbo, all those kinds of
don't
things.
Don't say Alice in Wonderland.
Well, no, but it applies, even if you still like the movie, but I think the criticism still applies, because then Tim Burton is then no longer bringing an animated sensibility to live-action cinema. He's just animating the world in the same way that CGI animates the world in general. So you no longer get that kind of interesting uncanniness that early Tim Burton has. Mm-hmm. You get a kind of less satisfying uncanniness that comes from oversaturation of CGI. So whereas in the original Beetlejuice, for instance, you get the wonderful scene I was describing where you see like the inner workings of the death administration. There's all these like pipes and tubes and things on wires and everything rumbling around, and it's confined and it's all practical. It looks deep and real and beautiful. And if you compare that to something in Alice in Wonderland, where you have these kind of endless vistas, endless animated vistas of, you know, animated playing cards and like weird wishy-washy dreamscapes and everything, that loses the element of tactile reality that made the early Tim Burton stuff work so well on screen. To get back to my previous point about the new Beetlejuice movie, I like some of the stuff here because it does look like a return to some of that previous kind of style. There's a lot more. I don't know how much of it was CGI or not, but a lot of it at least had a look of being a lot more practical, a lot more real. And it seemed like a return to a more traditional Tim Burton aesthetic.
That's so true, actually. So much of the stuff that I really like about his art is that stop motion animation. So like the new Frankenweenie, I thought actually, and I thought the old Frankenweenie, I watched both, really worked for me.
I love those movies. Those are by far my favorite of his.
Oh, they are. What makes them your favorite of for?
Well, I mean, so I'm a big fan of old Universal monster movies first, right? So I love Frankenstein. I love old Wolfman, Mummy, whatever. So I just love those movies. And then I love that he takes like what makes those movies so interesting and he brings it to animation. I genuinely can't believe that Disney let him do it. Like brings it to animation and he brings like all those sensibilities to it. So I think that is by far one of the most inventive movies that he's made. I love this in black and white. I love like just how demented it is. That is by far my favorite Tim Burton movie. I really enjoyed that.
Did you see the short, the 24 minute?
Yeah, I saw the original short.
I think maybe the short is almost as good as the eventual movie, which
I'll probably agree with.
Is, you know, so much less effort went into the short. And even on the Disney streaming platform, there is a making of for the full movie that shows you they spent all day on like a few seconds of stop motion. And obviously it's not Tim Burton moving all the things in there, but he's like being the George Lucas that he designed, or more than the George Lucas, because he actually is, you know, has the original illustrations. And the whole reason that he did the new one, according to this, was because having an actual dog, as cute as that is, with stitches drawn on its head and things, it was not going to be as expressive as he wanted this animated character to be. So it was all about, I want to have this character, and everything gets sized to the eventual Frankenweenie puppet that they came up with. So, I mean, it's just what he did with that and Nightmare Before Christmas, just this design aesthetic is, I mean, that's the thing he's going to be most remembered for. But as far as the story and the plot, like the plot of the original short was plenty cute. The extra things that they added for the animated, having like five of his friends bring their own things to life, were mostly superfluous and did not help that much. And I wish it were a shorter film.
I liked it though. And just getting some of the original had Shelley Duvall in it.
Yes.
And
Daniel Stern.
Daniel Stern and the kid from Neverending Story. The kid who is reading, not the kid who lost his horse.
Other high points? I mean, I feel like Ed Wood, at one point at least, I had considered my favorite movie. I sort of forgot for a while that this was, but yeah, I think that the pacing in that.
Yeah, I did a rewatch of that.
And the acting in that, and just, mm-hmm. you know, it helps if you know something about the original Ed Wood and have seen some of his movies and things. But it was such a tribute. I don't know that is actually giving up some of his, you have in the opening credits, some of his animation, Tim Burton's animation. But other than that, it's, you know, just him trying to direct a straight piece. You said, Lawrence, this is the best thing he's done in 10 years. Well, Big Eyes was only 10 years ago. And I thought that was, you know, as far as just directing a straight piece.
A straight piece,
Quite good. I mean, yes, this art style of this person who he's writing about is sort of a little Tim Burton-esque and weird. But, you know, that wasn't his creation. But it just shows I think he is a good director. And I'm going to go out on a limb. I'd never seen the Dumbo. I think Dumbo was quite good for what it was. I wish that he had done the new Pinocchio, then it wouldn't have sucked so bad. The Disney Pinocchio.
I'm going to agree with you, Mark. I thought Dumbo, when you compare this Dumbo to the original Dumbo, the original Dumbo is better. I mean, it's no...
I hate the original Dumbo, so...
Really?
It's low-key kind of racist. I mean, it definitely is.
I think it's the worst Disney movie. It has no plot. It's just people being mean to each other or to animals, and yeah.
And then a lovely, nice little racist number. So the original Dumbo, I mean, if you compare those two things, some people are going to really have an affinity for the original. But I thought that this Dumbo, yes, it's not great. But again, I don't need every movie that I watch to be great. I just do not. I'm perfectly fine with a solid, good B-plus movie. Not every movie needs to be something worthy of an Academy Award nomination. Now, when you talk about, I think Ed Wood is good. I'm going to be honest with you. One of my other favorite movies by Tim Burton is Mars Attacks. But it is so fun, right?
It's very silly.
Is having fun. He's at his best when he's just unleashed and he's having fun. Now, the past few years, he's been working a lot with Disney, and they tend to clamp down on their filmmaking.
They do.
Mm-hmm. And so that's the reason why I'm surprised that I enjoyed Frankenweenie so much, because they tend to clamp down on their filmmakers. So him in that Disney machine probably clamped down some of his creativity. But when he is unleashed, he's very fun.
The thing I was complaining about with Frankenweenie is the script. That's got to be so much pressure. Like every line I write is going to cost some animators like a week of their life. So everything's got to be. And it just seems like every other kid movie, these Pixar movies that, you know, it just seems. It was overwritten. You know, it's fine. Like it's not terrible acting or just clunkers, but it just did not have the spirit. It did not have the whimsical character of, say, Edward Scissorhands. If Frankenweenie's, the new script matched that, even in being kid friendly, I would be much more in favor of it.
That movie, and maybe because my dog just died a few weeks ago, it's probably too soon for me to see Frankenweenie, but that movie had me in just bawling by the end.
Sure.
That movie was kind of knocked me out, but it might have just been the timing for me.
It does work that angle well. I'll give it.
It definitely does. Yes, it definitely does. But I thought it was beautiful. I also think the animation is beautiful. I thought that Mars Attack was just a beautiful looking movie. I thought it was stupid and silly, but the look of that movie is absolutely original, unique. It was Tim Burton all the way.
He's someone who really, really shines when he's, I guess, paying homage to something that he loves. So we've talked about Edward. Edward is an absolute masterpiece and might be my favorite version of an auteur filmmaker, like having a masturbatory exploration of like Hollywood and making a movie about making movies. You described it as a straight live action piece, Mark, but it is also like visually very Tim Burton-y. There's a lot of cartoonish like stuff going on, and the way like the movie is shot, like it's happening in an Ed Wood movie, is just, I mean, it's delightful and really smart and like sings on the screen. But I think the problem with Tim Burton is he's undoubtedly a great filmmaker. And what's kind of tragic, I guess, about his like lackluster, the latter part of his career, is that he put stuff on screen that had never been put on screen before. His kind of cartoonish, childish, gothic sensibility is completely unique and utterly like charming and brilliant. Nobody else could have done what he's done. Like Nightmare Before Christmas, fully formative movie for me. His Batman movies, completely formative, like in the revolutionized Batman, like arguably invented the modern superhero movie. And Edward Scissorhands is like likewise a masterpiece. There's a guy and Pee Wee's Big Adventure. He had so many unbelievably quality movies in the first few years. So it's just kind of a little bit disappointing when he puts out stuff that isn't perfect, just because he's capable of such wonderful stuff. But it's really, can't really deny the guy's talent and impact, and just the quantity of movies that are fantastic that he's put out is incredibly impressive.
I wonder if some of it, because Nightmare Before Christmas, I thought he had directed that for the longest time, but he didn't. It's based on his own story and it's based on his own animations.
Art style.
His art. But it wasn't, he didn't direct it. And I wonder.
Yeah, that's Henry Selick.
Yeah, Henry Selick, who also, did he do Coraline also?
Yes, and James and the Giant Peach.
So anyway, so.
Became his own thing.
So I wonder if some of these collaborations, you know, he does well, not necessarily fighting against, you know, like a big entity like Disney, but he does better when he's collaborating with other people who have share his sensibilities. Like his movie, you know, when he has Danny Elfman doing his soundtracks, you know, as Ed Wood is great. Danny Elfman didn't do the soundtrack for that. But, you know, when he has these collaborations between these big creators who share some of his sensibilities, maybe that's when we get his best work. And it's also probably why he works with so many of the same people. I mean, I'm just looking at, like, Catherine O'Hara has been in countless of his movies. Paul Rubens, he worked with a lot. You know, it's just, and it's really fun to see these same actors kind of pop up over and over again.
That is interesting that Tim Burton actually directed Frankenweenie, but did not direct Nightmare Before Christmas, and was a co-director, I guess, of Corpse Bride, which is one that bored me at the time. I wasn't that impressed. I rewatched it this time. I liked it better, but it's sort of like the action scene at the end of it, I think, points out one of his weak points. I don't think he's an action director. I just watched Miss Peregrine's School of Peculiar Children. The end of that is absurd. This big fight that they have. I don't know whether to blame him or the writers, but I wish that was not in there.
The fact that stuff like The Nightmare Before Christmas works so well, even when it's being spearheaded by someone else, I think speaks to something about his aesthetic. The fact that it seems to be so easy for people to get it and to produce stuff which is so consistent. No one would be surprised to be told that Nightmare Before Christmas was directed by Tim Burton. It seeps Tim Burton through the pores, and clearly the team behind it fully understand Tim Burton's sensibility and where he's coming from. And I think that says something special about the sensibility in the first place. It's such a guessable, approachable might be the word, an inviting kind of aesthetic world that he draws. Even though it is distinctive and at the time it was very new, it was still got really popular for a reason, because it was a new weird thing that the culture didn't realize that it needed. Like, did anyone know that Edward Scissorhands was going to be like the feel-good hit of the summer? It doesn't feel... If you gave the elevator pitch for Edward Scissorhands, you wouldn't guess that it was going to be a box office sensation.
That's true. That was after Batman, though. That was in between Batmans. It does feel like he's got a one for me, one for you kind of attitude.
Yeah. And maybe in the latest Beetlejuice movie, that's like almost scene for scene. Maybe it's like, yeah, I'll do Beetlejuice doing the scary face with the camera behind him so you can't see what's going on. I'll do that gag again. But I also want to reference Corpse Bride.
Yes. Yes, he does.
The thing that surprised me most about Edward Scissorhands is I had forgotten Anthony Michael Hall's role in that how that he went from cute dork in 16 Candles to now I'm playing the jock bully, and okay, I don't need to see any more of him. That's so repellent.
But so, it was so funny because it just felt like, I mean, maybe that was what his whole plan was all along, is that, no, I'm going to be playing a meathead from now on, which seems like that's what his character choices have been, or they were back then. Why not?
It hasn't gone well for him since then.
I don't know. But yeah, he was good in it, though. He definitely was effective.
Hey, moms. Looking for some lighthearted guidance on this crazy journey we call parenting? Join me, Sabrina Kohlberg. And me, Andy Mitchell, for Pop Culture Moms, where each week we talk about what we're watching and examine our favorite pop culture moms up close to try to pick up some parenting hacks along the way. Come laugh, learn, and grow with us as we look for the best tips and maybe a few what not to do's from our favorite fictional moms. From Good Morning America and ABC Audio, Pop Culture Moms. Find it wherever you get your podcasts.
Oh, I wanted to know what you guys thought of Batman versus Batman Returns.
That's a great question.
I have to think about that. I haven't compared the two.
We had a Batman episode last year that you were not on. Lawrence and I did. So I think I rewatched both of those for that. And I think I saw it as pretty continuous. If anything, Batman Returns sort of was more, it didn't have like, right, let's take time out to have a whole Prince video, which was like what marred the original Batman movie, is that there was just some...
It marred it for you?
Maybe that's what's wrong with Beetlejuice, Beetlejuice. I didn't want the whole full-length cake out in the rain video at the end. That was too much. I liked how in the original Beetlejuice, there was a musical thing that was 30 seconds long, not however nightmarishly long, pointlessly long.
If you go back and watch that original Beetlejuice, it was pretty long. That original song was actually, believe it or not, it's pretty long.
The ending of the first Beetlejuice movie, rewatched that last night, and it read clearly to me as nobody knew how to end that movie. So instead, let's just dangle Winona Ryder from a wire and have her awkwardly like...
And Harry Belafonte, like you can't beat. I wanted more Harry Belafonte.
It was there, but it was like, we don't know how to end this movie, so this is what we're doing. And it was weird to see that paid homage to like something that was clearly It's weird to see that paid tribute to in the remake.
But going back to your original question, Sarah, now when I think about these two, the thing about the first Batman, it has a transformative acting credit with Jack Nicholson. It is just, he is so amazingly good.
That is his movie. Yeah.
That by far, that movie just kind of stands and towers above the first one just because of that acting performance. But as far as the sensibility, I think that the Catwoman, it's crazy. It's weird. I enjoyed it. Penguin, it's weird when at the end, like black sludge or whatever is coming out of his mouth, right? No. So I think...
Is it Danny DeVito's best role?
It might be. It legit might be. But Batman Begins is very much so a very much more Tim Burton film. And the original Batman seems as though he's really trying to work within the confines of what he's asked to do. So, I mean, the comparison of that, but that performance by Jack Nicholson is just so incredibly good. Even though it butchers the backstory of Joker, it is so incredibly good that I enjoyed it so much more than I did Batman.
Yeah, I mean, it just seems like it was such a funny choice to have him direct Batman after, what was the last big hit superhero movie? Was Superman, maybe?
It would have been Superman.
And that was such a yay America and Ronald Reagan. And, you know, it was just such a different...
And then they go to the guy who directed Beetlejuice and said, hey, let's do Batman now.
Let's do something really dark. Not that dark, but yeah. But anyway, but I thought it was such a funny turn, but it didn't seem like when he was doing Batman Returns, that really, really felt like a Tim Burton movie more than the original.
I think he makes sense as a directing choice for Batman then, if you remember that Batman in the cultural imagination at that time was Adam West and the Adam West TV show.
Yes,
good point.
Yes.
And if you've got a guy who has taken Pee-wee's Playhouse and put it on the big screen, and you need someone to take this, what everyone thinks about as an incredibly like camp cartoonish property, and work for that, then that makes sense as a choice. He clearly took some real Tim Burton-y decisions in how he was going to execute it. I don't think anyone expected it to be dark in the way that it was at the time. It probably was a surprise, and he took the gamble, and it really, really paid off. And then my abiding memory of the difference between Batman and Batman Returns is that Batman Returns, I was a young child when I watched it, and there is a lot of BDSM-adjacent imagery in Batman Returns that was not there in the first one. And that to me says that they let Tim Burton do a lot more of what he wanted to do in the second movie. And a lot of what he wanted to do was have Michelle Pfeiffer wearing leather and licking blood off herself.
Mm-hmm. She was great. She was amazing in that role.
Let's say that was formative.
So maybe it was another one of those things where DVDs were on sale at some point. So I had bought the DVD of Sleepy Hollow, but I had not watched it since I bought it, whenever that was in 2000 or whatever. And so I did rewatch it last night, and I felt probably the same about it, that there's really good things about the visuals, but as a whole, like the pacing is not great. Yeah, it just ultimately is a bit unsatisfying. And I feel like that is maybe where things started to go off the rails a little bit for him, if we want to say that he had his classic period and then... Now we're entering whether he's getting bigger budgets or getting to work on more IP, or I'm not exactly sure what it is.
Big Fish, though. I thought Big Fish was pretty good when it came out. I saw it in the theater. I haven't seen it since, but I remember really enjoying that film. And it's also kind of definitely not realistic. And it shares some of his sensibility, but I felt like he was stretching a little bit there.
It was a really different direction for him, but still recognizably a Tim Burton, because it's still very like fantastical and there's cool like fairy tale visuals going on everywhere, but it's much more grounded story-wise.
Yeah.
And I often think of that as Tim Burton's last good film. I haven't seen a couple of the ones that you guys referenced as being better, more recent ones, but that to me is his, marks the end of his like great creative output.
I didn't rewatch that one, but I remember it being a touching film.
Yeah.
And
yeah,
enjoying the way that the fantasy elements played in, such that it was not doing this, what's the Mexican holiday, Halloween holiday?
Day of the Dead.
Muertos.
Yes, yes. I feel like that is the shtick that he is appropriating for quite a lot of his The Corpse Bride and this. If we're going to be talking about that and having skeletons run around. And frankly, and I say this as someone who owns all the Oingo Boingo albums on CD, I'm tired of Danny Elfman's shtick. Like, I really liked it the first seven movies that he scored. And I just feel like he has a narrow enough palette. He's not John Williams. He just can't do that many things. So this whole let's play xylophone on the skeleton's ribs kind of shtick, I feel like, is why I think maybe we've taken, that I take Tim Burton for granted, like that this was a thing that happened that I was really enamored by. Maybe The Nightmare Before Christmas was sort of the height of. And now, like, if he's going to do something else, it better be like Big Fish. It better be something, not more of this old hat.
More of the same.
That's part of what has been disappointing, I think, about the last part of his career, is that instead of taking some parts of his sensibility and trying them out, trying them in different kinds of projects like Big Fish, he's kind of reverted to retreading more like traditionally, not even traditionally, like skin deep Tim Burton-esque things, stuff like Charlie and the Chocolate Factory and whatever. It feels almost like an early Tim Burton movie, but there's something like not very crunchy or satisfying about it. Maybe he would have done better trying to be more experimental, but I'm sure there were like business reasons why he took the decisions that he did.
It's kind of amazing that he wasn't involved in the earlier Addams Family movies, because that is so much his brand, or the brand that he had decided was his and his alone. Yeah, so I didn't realize he directed quite as many episodes of this show Wednesday. I had only ever watched the first episode. I watched the first two in preparation for this. And again, it's the same writers.
You never seen Wednesday?
Well, I haven't like watched the whole series. I don't know. Maybe we could have an Addams Family.
I watched the first couple episodes just to kind of get a sense of it, but it's not, I don't think I'm not the audience.
Right. It's Riverdale.
It was a phenomenon in my house. Like when that show dropped, my kids were like, we have got to watch this now. And we,
that's the same here. Yeah.
And watched it straight through. I'm telling you, like it, and that show is by far one of the best things Tim Burton has done in a very long time, which leads us to my next question. By the way, we have not even talked about Jenna Ortega. Like, what did you guys think about her in Beetlejuice? Like, I don't know if I like her or not, but what do you guys think about her?
I think compelling enough. I think she does that part really well. And having a slightly different, that she's not the Wednesday character, that she's the more normal teen in this. I thought she did just fine.
Yeah, I thought she was fine.
If you guys want younger people to listen to us, y'all better talk about Jenna Ortega, because she is a huge star. Like, she is a gigantic star. And that is what drew, I think, a lot of the box office, because the younger people were going to support the next Jenna Ortega thing. So, I mean, I thought she was fine. I don't like her stick of underplaying, smarmy kid thing, but it's a thing. It's a thing right now.
Maybe I don't want to feel too creepy in being too admiring of her. I don't want to say, oh, she has such a compelling gaze. Like, what are you looking? This is a little.
Oh my God. What are you doing, Mark? What's happening?
She's a, I mean, I think she's.
She's probably an adult now. Yes.
But anyway, but she's still, I think she's good at what she does. I haven't seen her in very much, and I haven't seen her, what her range could be. I'm sure she's a fine actress. But I didn't think that she was given a ton to do in Beetlejuice. But I think at what she was told to do in that movie was absolutely fine. She absolutely got the job done.
Tim Burton makes some, I don't know how much the casting is like in his gift in his movies, but he makes some incredibly good like casting decisions. We can talk about whether we get to praise or blame him for Johnny Depp's career, but we certainly get to either praise or blame him for Johnny Depp having the career that he does. And obviously there are endless jokes about the fact that he only ever casts either Johnny Depp or Helena Bonham Carter in any movies that he's making. But there's a reason that he does that. And he clearly sees the quality in the actors that are going to contribute to his style. Like, who would have thought that Michael Keaton would turn out to be the definitive Tim Burton, like, screen presence? Like, you can see it in Johnny Depp and Helena Bonham Carter, but who knew that Michael Keaton would be that guy?
Or that he could get someone like the Joker. Why?
Jack Nicholson.
Jack Nicholson.
Yeah, Jack Nicholson.
Jack Nicholson. Like, Jack Nicholson wants to work with him. You know, he was in, what did he have, 3 roles in Mars Attacks?
At least 2.
I think he did. Like, he had, yeah, I think he might have had 3. I think that Tim Burton is a really, really good director of actors. I have always felt that, that even in the films that don't work necessarily overall, he always gets, so for example, I would have been just fine if we had just left Charlie and the Chocolate Factory in the 1970s and left it alone there. Because that is by far one of my favorite movies of all time. I really enjoyed that. We didn't need this. But that performance that Johnny Depp gives in that movie, it is so interesting. And it's quite good and it's weird. It's like soft-spoken and also kind of manic. Like, it's a really good performance if you go back and you watch that. It's a really good. Now, the movie itself doesn't work for me. I don't like the movie. But that performance is so incredibly weird. He's really good with his actors. Yeah, he's really good with his actors.
Decisions. It's a lot of Tim Burton's worst output is often like interesting but bad ideas flawlessly executed. Like, there's a lot of very, very good, like Charlie and the Chocolate Factory in particular is clearly exactly what he wanted on screen is on screen. He just shouldn't have wanted to put that on screen.
And I wish that they would just left that IP alone. Like, just leave it alone. Don't touch that. Let that be weird. Let that be alone by itself.
I don't mind the idea of refreshing something, especially with massive improvements in technology. And maybe the next one will be better. But we could have a separate Charlie and the Chocolate, you know, just stuff related to that.
Wonka and all of that. Yeah.
Roald Dahl.
To Roald Dahl stuff. I know we've sort of touched on that in some of the other episodes about
Noah's
recent really kids like stuff or whatever, but.
There was that recent Netflix series of short stories of his.
Mm. I forgot what the name of that was, but yeah, I know. Oh. Directed by Wes Anderson. Yeah, I know what you're talking about.
Mm-hmm. All right, well, we should close this down. Any final thoughts, any films that we haven't mentioned that you feel like, oh gosh, we really need to get that on the table or other comments?
I respect the hell out of Tim Burton, I think, for the majority of his career. And I wanted to bring up the specter of Sweeney Todd, because that is another, it's interesting because I hate that movie because I think the sound production is one of those musical movies which does a really poor job with just the sound production. And it just makes the movie very hard to watch. But visually and in conception and in most of the execution, it's great. He's a really interesting and distinctive filmmaker, and he's responsible for a lot of really beloved movies that he should be extremely proud of. And I hope he gets to make more good movies. I don't know what stops him making good movies. I feel like he's still able to, and I hope he makes some more.
Well said, Al. I agree.
Yeah, I feel like he can have his fingers in almost any IP that he wants to. He's just one of those.
But I don't.
That it was, even though we hadn't had a Tim Burton episode, there were like multiple movies that we did. Batman, we did Planet of the Apes, we did a Dark Shadows one that I've already had to watch. I watched Sweeney Todd for, I'm not sure which episode, maybe the Sacha Baron Cohen episode, or maybe the, I know we were talking about doing a Stephen Sondheim thing, but yeah, these are definitely still top of mind. And it's just, it's amazing that he has stayed as relevant as he has.
Maybe stay away from the IP for him. Like, maybe go back and do more original stuff, even if it doesn't always wholly work. I'd rather have a Mars Attacks, you know, another Mars Attacks than have another Dumbo.
I don't know what the story of with the Miss Peregrine or why he did that, but there was a book that my kids were talking about. I actually even listened to part of the audiobook to try to see how this was as a presentation of it. And, you know, I don't know whether that's considered IP or not, because he was trying to set up this novel as bankable IP.
That was in the wake of Harry Potter, though. He was like, the studio was like, you're going to be our Chris Columbus and we're going to make this the new Harry Potter. And you can see why everyone thought that would work.
Look, guys, it's been 10 years since Tim Burton has done an original thing, the thing that Sarah says that she wants him to do. And I think that speaks to the state of the industry right now. It is really, really hard to get the funding for movies that are not IP. It is
That's
hard,
true.
Right? And the kind of movies that he makes are not movies that are made for cheaply. Like back in the day, he might have done them for cheap, but he can't do that anymore. Not with the kind of ideas that he has and the imagination that he has. So if you look for the past 10 years, like 10 years ago was Big Eyes, which you guys praised. Miss Peregrine, that's something that a studio came to him and said, make this movie for us. He did it. Dumbo, that's a retread. Beetlejuice, Beetlejuice, that's a retread. It's hard to do these original movies. It just is. Even if you have the greatest ideas in the world, to get the funding for it, it's really, really hard. So I'm happy with what he's done. I think that he has done as well as he possibly could. Would I like for him to have made Beetlejuice a little bit more streamlined and get rid of some of these extra characters? Although that kid, the boy who was messing around with Jenna Ortega, I kind of like that twist. I thought that was wonderful.
Why not? You need it. We need somebody to be a villain.
Yeah, I could have done without that stuff. Well, I mean,
she did not need a love interest.
Well, he wasn't a love interest. It was fun that he ended up being a scumbag. That's what made that fun. Bottom line, though, he could have got rid of, like, Justin Theroux, get rid of that. Monica Bellucci, get rid of that. That movie would have worked much better. I would have liked it a much better point.
We also didn't need as much Jeffrey Jones in it either.
That was yet another one of the distractions. We can talk about that in the after talk here.
Who's Jeffrey? I don't know. Well,
yeah, people can Google it.
We can look that. You go look that up.
All right. Yes. If people want to hear that, the after talk, we will
get rid of that character.
We'll give the details of this. You got to go to patreon.com.
You want salacious gossip? You got to pay.
But they got rid of him.
Thanks,
anyway,
everybody.
Watch more Tim Burton.
All right.
Bye.
Bye.
Get more Pretty Much Pop at prettymuchpop.com. Get bonus content for every episode at patreon.com/prettymuchpop. Pretty Much Pop is part of the Partially Examined Life podcast network, and it's also presented by openculture.com.